They look different. What you think you are seeing isn't always what you are seeing. You don't yet have the experience to distinguish between the things you see. You need to learn to ignore the irrelevant stuff.
Forgive me for saying so, but it looked like...
Are you arguing with me, Major?
Hatcher roared, the color rising in his cheeks.
No, sir, but I've had 12 years combat air experience, and have logged thousands of hours in the air. My instincts should count for something. If they don't, why am I here?
Your talent is not in doubt, Major, said Hatcher. But to answer your question, you're here to learn. Remember that. You are in charge of a craft that costs as much as the GNP of several small countries, flying it for the first time, God help you, in low Earth orbit. Do you know what would have happened if you'd lost control of it, or hit something? You are not God, Alan. It may hurt to admit it, but in spite of all your experience, this is a new field for you. You are effectively a cadet. I've listened to the recordings. You disobeyed 3 direct orders and put your craft in peril, on what amounted to no more than a sensory hunch, a glitch. In any other program, you'd not only be grounded, you'd be out. You know that?
Alan hesitated, then nodded.
Hatcher looked at him for a long moment, then nodded back.
I don't think I need to tell you to keep your nose clean from here on, said Hatcher, returning to his desk. You will not be given another chance.
The next day, Alan told Regis what had happened, or as much of it as security protocols permitted. The big man shook his head in wonder.
I can't believe they didn't ground you, he said.
Me too, said Alan.
In fact, he wasn't even given a day off. That evening, he was summoned to the Papoose Lake hangar and directed back to the Locust. There was no sign of either Hatcher or Marat. The man who gave him his instructions was the suited man with the clipboard he'd seen before, but did not know. The man was freckled, red-headed, and his name badge said Reardon.
Stay in U.S. airspace and do not leave the troposphere.
That's it, said Alan. Nothing more specific?
Consider it free flight practice, said Reardon.
If he knew Alan was in the doghouse, he gave no sign of it. The ground crew wore helmets that partly covered their faces. Alan was struck, as he boarded the ship, by Hal, apart from Regis, with whom he was still rebuilding his friendship. He knew almost no one at the base, except for the people who seemed most pissed off at him. It was a depressing thought, not because he was a particularly social animal. He never had been. It was one of the things Lacey had found hardest to deal with about him. He didn't ordinarily crave company, and was happiest, he'd once stupidly admitted to her, when he was alone. But now he felt a strange urge to talk to someone, anyone, about what he was going through, about the world he had discovered, and the ship he was flying. He wanted to discuss its strangeness, and the truly awesome feeling of being at the helm. He wanted to describe what it was like to dart across the sky at Mach 7 over the Atlantic, or angle his way between satellites as the Earth turned slowly beneath him. But he couldn't. The only people he could talk to about his experiences were watching him for signs that he couldn't handle his assignment, waiting for him to screw up one more time. He should get a beer with Regis after the mission, off base, as old friends. He took the Locust up, turned its lights out, and put the craft through a series of maneuvers over the Rockies and out over Utah's Great Salt Lake, before selecting the coordinates for Riverside, Iowa, the fictional home of Star Trek's Captain James T. Kirk. If he was going to be accused of acting on a whim, he may as well do the thing right. He moved over it at 20,000 feet, watching for air traffic, then found a solitary farm and settled into a Dare Air hover only 600 feet above its barn. The sky was moonless, but there were lights on in the house. Alan watched as a young man came home in an old pickup, went inside, then came out again with a beer, and sat on the stoop to drink it. The young man was oblivious, sipping his beer and gazing up at the stars, unaware that a portion of them above the house had been blotted out by an impossible triangular ship. Hatcher had warned Alan that he wasn't God. Obviously. So obvious, in fact, that at the time Alan was surprised that the CIA man had trouble to say it at all. But here he was, watching from the silent heavens, as the man on his porch wiped his mouth, took his empty beer bottle inside, and closed up the house for the night. "Of course I'm not God," Alan reminded himself aloud, "but sometimes it sure does feel like it." Alan made 4 flights in the next week, 2 into low Earth orbit. At no time did he glimpse anything like the Arrowhead craft he'd seen that first time with Marat. The strange ship tugged at the edge of Alan's memory. A delta-shaped question mark that still made him wonder what was still being kept from him. That week, Alan saw Hatcher only once, and Marat not at all. When he asked about him, he was told only that Agent Marat was not on base at this time, though whether he'd gone via Gulfstream to Andrews Air Force Base, or by Locust to the Congo Basin, or to the International Space Station, no one was saying. He saw Reardon, the red-haired man, twice, but still did not know his precise rank or function. His orders were sent by encrypted email to his tablet, which he then inserted into a dock in the cockpit of the Locust. He spent what free time he had with Barry Regis, reminiscing, playing cards, low stress, non-classified stuff. And he relished it all the more because he knew that friendship was virtually unknown on the base. There were other pilots he knew, but he had never been introduced to them. People came in to work and were bussed out. Those who stayed on kept to themselves, as they were told to. Life going on in intentional isolation. Twice as he sat with Regis, Alan had seen Hatcher. And twice he'd read in Hatcher's face a kind of deliberate permission. Alan's mental health was being looked after. He was okay with that. His missions were generally just getting familiar with the craft. They also had a reconnaissance component, though it was not always clear what he was looking for. He was given coordinates, and sometimes a flight plan, told to engage his sensors and recording devices at key moments. All of the flights were in darkness, the sensors gathering far more information than Alan could actually get with his own senses. The missions were as dull as could be in such a futuristic ship with quirks and capabilities that were still new to him. Even so, a pattern emerged. Every location patrolled, cautiously and at altitude, lights out and countermeasures engaged, took place over a single icy swatch of the globe. Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and Russia. Each mission avoided population centers. Not hard, where the territory was vast and the population small and nomadic, and focused on remote facilities accessed by long, lonely roads, characterized by windowless concrete structures, security walls, and minor airfields. Some of them showed circular structures that might have been the tops of missile silos. But the places might just as easily have been training camps or nuclear power stations. There was no way of knowing from what he could see, and the viewers, even with night vision mode enabled, gave him little to go on. The Locust, often sitting motionless in the sky for minutes, or even hours, shot ultra-high-resolution footage that an onboard computer processed, using a complex algorithm that analyzed minute vibrations at ordinary objects. Plants, glass windows, cans of soda. These could, Professor Beaker had told him, be decoded into speech, recreating any conversations that took place in proximity to those objects. Much of it would be unusable. Some of it would be coherent, but useless. But a tiny fraction, said Beaker, would be gold. After each mission, as Alan slouched off to debriefing, and another day of classes and simulations, the same nameless tech in a blue flight suit boarded the ship, downloaded the data to a handheld computer, and deleted and wrote over all records from the Locust's hard drive. Alan had gone, he thought bleakly, from being a god to being a drone. He said as much to Hatcher when they met to debrief at the end of the week.
"The work is not sufficiently interesting for you, Major?" asked Hatcher, dry as the desert air.
"It's not that, sir," said Alan. "It just feels like I'm doing a job you could do just as well with a Reaper controlled from one of those Vegas trailers the media loves to talk about, rather than risk exposing of the Locust. What makes you think it's the bases we're surveilling?"
"As opposed to what?" Alan replied.
For a moment, Hatcher said nothing, watching Alan, smiling slightly as realization dawned in the pilot's face.
"Me," Alan said. "It's not about the ground locations at all. You're monitoring me."
Hatcher's fractional shrug conceded the point. "Partly," he said. "We have to be sure you can follow orders and operate safely in foreign airspace. And the data you have been collecting has been very useful. No one is wasting your time, Major."
This was in response to Alan's frown and the way he looked into the corner of the room.
"So I passed?" he said at last.
"It wasn't a test," said Hatcher, though he chuckled at Alan's raised eyebrow.
"Okay, it was kind of a test. And yes, you passed. And before you can ask what you won for doing so, I'd like to give you your new assignment."
He handed over his tablet, and Alan scrolled through the details. Halfway through, he looked up, shocked.
"This is a daylight op," he said.
"Yes."
"Over Moscow?"
"Yes. We have an agent waiting to upload some data."
"I'll get shot down."
"You know the craft's evasive capacity and speed," said Hatcher. "And there are countermeasures we have not yet revealed to you, which will help."
"Such as?"
Hatcher thought for a moment, then decided.
"Come with me," he said.
They rode the empty, blacked-out school bus to the Papoose facility, but walked further, to a different door in the cliff, and another hangar. Hatcher led the way, typing his codes and going through weight and retinal checks at each door. The crew inside still looked up with surprise when he entered, Alan a half step behind. They were working on a pair of Locusts, though whether they were the ones he and Morant had flown, Alan couldn't tell. The craft bore no insignia or identifying marks. One was partially disassembled, the skin of its great angular wing peeled back in panels to reveal the workings within. Beyond it was another door. It was open, showing another hangar and, sitting alone in the middle, a silvery disc, a classic flying saucer, sleek and round, with a central bulge that seemed to have windows, the rest clad in steel or aluminum, bright as chrome. It seemed to sit in midair, though at this distance, it was impossible to be sure it wasn't suspended or otherwise held up by something Alan couldn't see. He angled his head to get a better look, and one of the ground crew was suddenly in his face and shouting, his hands up. It took a second for Alan to realize he wasn't the one being yelled at. A soldier, standing behind the first Locust, came around its long knife-like wing with his M4 at the ready. Alan hastily turned back to face the door they'd come in through, raising his hands. When he turned back, the door into the hangar beyond had been rolled shut, and the saucer, whatever it was, had vanished. Hatcher gave him a thoughtful look, then snapped a smile into place.
"Sorry about that," he said, as the place went back to work as if nothing had happened. "Prototype. Best to put it out of your mind."
"I can try," said Alan.
"So," said Hatcher, walking purposefully to the tech who'd raised the alarm, "I'm here to show Major Young the cloak. He'll be using it this afternoon. My clearance," he added, showing his tablet. "And his."
The tech scanned the computer documents and then double-checked them on a device of his own. while a single word bounced around in Alan's head. Cloak. He watched the technician climb the stairs into the cockpit, blinking as one of the craft's power systems engaged, and a light ran around the triangular wing. Alan shot Hatcher a dubious look, a half-smile that said this was all a kind of joke that he was already in on. Cloaking? They couldn't be serious. It must be some kind of radar countermeasure, something that confused ground arrays, bouncing the signal to make it shift, or cause it to be mistaken for a flock of birds, or... The closest locust vanished. One moment, it had been there. The next, without a sound, the air seemed to ripple, and it was gone. Or very nearly. Alan could see through the space where the ship had been, to the partially disassembled craft behind it, and the wall of the hangar, with its now carefully closed door. But there was something very slightly off about the image. It wasn't just that his brain rebelled against the idea of seeing through something so obviously solid. The ripple effect that had marked the ship's disappearance hadn't gone completely, and when he looked to the other locust, it seemed like things were not exactly in the right place. Close. Very close, in fact, but not quite. He followed a seam in the concrete floor and watched the way it seemed to break and continue an inch or two out of place before reconnecting with its proper line on the other side. The ship was clearly still there, but somehow something was bending his sight around it. My eyes are made the fools of the other senses, he thought. A line from Shakespeare that some part of his brain had retained since high school. It had never made sense to him until now. He shifted from foot to foot, watching the way his vision changed, so that it was just possible to imagine the shape that was so bizarrely lost to sight. Without turning away, he asked the question he always seemed to be asking these days. How is this possible? He got the usual answer. Doesn't really matter, does it? Said Hatcher. If it helps, it's all about bending light. Light normally travels in straight lines, and you see along those lines. If they can be distorted around an object, the eye, following the curved lines, can be fooled into thinking it's seeing normally, when in fact, the system has created a visual dead space in the center. And just so you know, it will disengage if you go over Mach 1. It's not flawless, but it is, as they say, close enough for government work. Alan gaped at him, then, as the cloak was disengaged, back at the ship that seemed somehow even more magical, now that he could see it again. This, gentlemen, will show you how to engage the system and when to use it, said Hatcher. And don't get overconfident. The cloak generates an ion signature of its own that could actually make it easier for certain sophisticated tracking systems to lock onto it. So don't assume you're truly invisible. We'll activate the onboard computer's vocal interface so that you can simply speak commands. The voice recognition software is state-of-the-art, but then you'd expect that. Yes. You won't be able to talk to us, however, not with the cloak engaged. Understood. If you see evidence that you've been detected, Hatcher said, you hit the home button. I don't care how much of the mission has been completed. You return to base immediately by the fastest safe route. You got that, Major? Immediately. This is your primary directive. Hesitate, dodge, decide to go exploring, discharge your weapons, or otherwise disobey that fundamental principle, and you will never fly in this or any similar craft again. Are we clear?
Crystal, said Alan.
Okay, said Hatcher. Bring us back some nice pictures of the Kremlin. The first part of the mission went fine. Alan engaged the cloak 20 minutes before sunrise, crossing into Russian airspace at 10 minutes after 9 a.m. local. An hour later, he was over Moscow, his multi-source situational awareness display swarming with aircraft, most of them civilian. but he saw no evidence that any of them knew he was there. His orders required him to drop to 1,000 feet over Red Square, where he would have to hold position for exactly 6 minutes, while his systems uploaded the data being transmitted to him from an operative below. It was utterly surreal. The locust hung there in the bright morning sun, and below him, Alan could see the colorful onion bulb minarets of St. Basil's Cathedral, and the long angular brick wall and towers surrounding the Kremlin complex. Alan was old enough to recall those tedious, terrifying Soviet armored parades from the Reagan era. All those olive-green tanks and missile carriers driving slowly past the balcony, while Politburo officials stood ramrod straight. And now he was here, in a different age, but still, in a sense, an invader. Alan did not pay attention to politics. He had long since decided it was best for someone in his position not to. It muddied the waters. But he was curious as to what was going on, and what he was participating in, however unwittingly. He checked the onboard chronometer. 3 minutes and 10 seconds. He drummed his fingers on his armrest. The silence of his engines unnerved him, as did the flickers of light from his MSSA scanner, as yet another plane headed out of the city. He toggled between the political, topographical, and multispectral settings that formed the background to the transponder, IFF, and other integrated feeds. The locust avoided the easily detectable pinging of radar by operating passive interferometrics, utilizing the ambient radio frequencies from all other transmissions to discover, ID, and track those surface contacts and unknowns that were collectively known as skunks. There was a long white building with an ornamental gilded roof along one side of the square. People were coming and going, though there was less bustle than he had expected. 4 minutes. The upload bar was filling slowly. Alan had asked Hatcher why their operative couldn't just upload to Dropbox or something, like everybody else. But Hatcher had only smiled and shook his head. "Because the Internet is so secure, you mean?" he said. 3 minutes. Something flashed on his MSSA screen. 2 somethings. They were coming towards him, though that was surely coincidence. Alan looked to adjust position without breaking the upload connection, sliding the ship to the side and lowering another 100 feet. The 2 craft on the MSSA made the same adjustment, and now a siren shrieked through the cockpit. There was no doubt about it. The 2 planes, if that was what they were on an intercept course. Someone could see him. Some kind of bistatic radar designed to spot low observable platforms. Perhaps, though it was surprising. Cursing, Alan disengaged the upload with 87 seconds still on the clock. The cockpit rang with the cycling siren, and a serene female voice came through his headphones from the onboard computer. 2 aircraft on attack vector. Configuration matches Sukhoi SU-30. Engaging avoidance systems. Alan grimaced. The SU-30, what he was used to calling a Flanker C, was a fast and maneuverable fighter, but it was no match for the speed of the Locust. He sent the craft into a near vertical climb and gunned the engine to just below Mach 1 to keep the cloak intact as long as he dared. Moscow fell away beneath him as he pushed the ship as close to the speed of sound as he could. He scanned the MSSA. The fighters were closing fast. In seconds, they would be in combat range. He waited, shooting out over the suburban sprawl north of Moscow, then pulling east, where there were few towns. There was a lake showing on his map. The flankers were almost on him. "Incoming aircraft weapons systems online and searching for target," said the computer evenly. 1 more second. He breathed. "Missile away and incoming," said the computer. 1.5 seconds. Alan slid his speed gauge to Mach 4 and punched the controls. He felt it this time, the slide and pop as he shed the cloak and tore across the sky, climbing all the time. The missiles fell behind him, and the fighters that released them immediately slowed, banking, as if they thought they'd overshot him. Alan released a whoop of triumph, suddenly conscious of the sweat on his upper lip. The lake was already behind him. He'd need to decide whether to keep going east or double back over Europe and the Atlantic. He began some hasty mental calculations, tracking the position of the sun. If he were going home with his tail between his legs and hostile fighters on the sniff, he'd be better doing it in darkness. "Incoming craft," said the computer. "Attack vector." "I already lost them," he muttered. "New contact," said the computer. "What?" Alan gasped. "Where? I don't see it. How can they follow me at this speed?" "That is unknown at this time." "What kind of aircraft are they?" he said, correcting his course, and increasing speed to almost Mach 5. "Non-conventional," said the computer. Alan hesitated, shaking his head as if to clear it. "What does that mean?" "Configuration of pursuing aircraft is classified," said the computer placidly. He saw it now, a blip on his MSSA, in his slipstream, no more than 4 nautical miles behind him. It was matching his speed. Alan stared. "Okay," he said. "Let's see how you like heights." And he pointed the Locust straight up. "You might be fast," he snarled, "but I'm pretty sure you can't handle space." "Intercept aircraft closing," said the computer. It was impossible. Alan swung his chair around and stared through what was now the Locust's rear window. There, bursting through the cloud layer into the bright blue stratosphere, hard on his tail, was a ship, chrome bright and shaped like an arrowhead. As Alan gazed aghast, he saw the unmistakable flash of something in the nose. He was under fire. He pulled the Locust hard to the left, rolling it and changing direction. There was no point trying to lose his pursuer in space. He had already seen the ship, or one very like it, up there, and knew it could match him turn for turn. As the Locust rolled, he saw a flash of light stab past him. Lasers. He dived, reaching for the red homing button, and turned on the auto-flight planner, thinking furiously about Hatcher's order that he not engage his weapons. "Decrease speed before engaging homing device," said the computer. "Not really an option," said Alan, corkscrewing the Locust away from another flash of enemy fire. He came out of the roll and checked his six. The arrowhead was still in pursuit. If its weapons were locked on, he was about to find out. He pulled the Locust's front point up, spiraled the body of the ship around, and pushed it as hard as it would go back towards the pursuing ship. He passed it, no more than 30 yards below his right wingtip, and its bright metal body filled his window as the arrowhead tried to pivot into a chase. Alan slammed the heel of his hand on the all-stop, and in the microsecond following, hit the homing button. The Locust seemed to hang motionless for a second, and then was tearing away, sliding out of the world and becoming not plane or bird, but the air itself. Alan felt a drag in his guts as the craft leapt away, faster than anything should ever move. Even so, even in that tiny fraction of a second, he saw the pop of console lights, the sudden bangs and screams of something impossible tearing through his hull, and knew, in the flare of firelight at his side, the shriek of pain in his face and hand, that he had been hit. 40. Jennifer, Washington, D.C. It took Jennifer a long time to get to sleep. She woke late in her D.C. hotel, her head brimming with the follow-up questions she wanted to take to Senator Powers. She brewed coffee in her room while she took a blisteringly hot shower, and now sat sipping the coffee unenthusiastically as she clicked through her email. Nothing. She flipped on the muted TV while she dressed. A local news station was detailing some personal tragedy and showing footage of police cars, their flashers rolling blue and red, intercut with an image of a young professional-looking woman and an older man in a suit. A familiar man. Powers. She stared, then turned on the sound. The 68-year-old senator from Nevada was found in the rented townhouse by his cleaning lady at 9 o'clock this morning. Though police have refused to comment on the case at this stage, the apparent suicide seems motivated by a pending story in the Washington Post detailing Senator Powers' affair with a junior aide. His family could not be reached for comment, but several members of his staff have expressed their shock and grief at this morning's developments. Jennifer was frozen in the act of buttoning up her blouse, hands stuck, as if her fingers had forgotten what to do. Her mouth and eyes were dry. She blinked deliberately, and something of the spell broke, allowing her to sit on the foot of the bed, as the images from the television washed over her. There was, as she supposed there always was, a barely suppressed predatory glee about the reporters, like jackals stumbling on an unattended leopard kill. This only intensified when it was revealed that the Washington Post, which had supposedly been about to reveal the senator's affair, had only gotten wind of the story from an anonymous source an hour before the alleged suicide had taken place. A spokesman from the paper, perhaps trying to mitigate his own responsibility, said he thought it unlikely that the senator's alleged suicide stemmed from any upcoming negative publicity, and that the newspaper had not even begun to verify the accusations made by the anonymous caller. "We get a dozen of these every week," said the reporter. "There's no reason to assume the story was going anywhere, at least in the short term." So the story developed a tang of intrigue as well. She could imagine the newsroom's delight as national interest focused on the story. Jennifer felt a kind of numb disbelief and, trailing it, a gnawing sense of responsibility for the death of the man she had met the night before. Could his conversation with her, there on the steps of the Jefferson Memorial, shrine to all that America was supposed to stand for, have left him with such a profound sense of failure that he'd taken his own life only hours later? But then the official reports of her own father's death, a man who'd been the senator's friend, said that he had also taken his own life, and she didn't believe that for a minute. If the two deaths were related, caused by the same people, it wasn't so great a leap to think her visit somehow precipitated the senator's demise. She shuddered at the thought, her anxiety undercut by a pang of sadness originating in her father's death, but somehow made fresh by this new tragedy. The two men had been in similar age, in temperament, even in their politics. For a moment, it was like she had lost her father again. There was a knock at the door. "Housekeeping," said a woman's voice. Jennifer stiffened. If her presence had in any way hastened Senator Power's death, they, Maynard or whoever, would know where she was staying, even though she had signed in with a fake name. It was absurd to hope otherwise. "Can you come back later, please?" she said, still taut and watchful. "No problem," said the voice. It had a lilt that might have been Hispanic. Jennifer listened for the sound of feet in the hallway, but heard nothing. She pressed her eye to the viewhole and saw, through the distorting fisheye lens, the back of a middle-aged woman pushing a cart loaded with towels and cleaning products, her head bound demurely with a scarf. Safe. For now. She snatched up the few things she'd brought with her and stuffed them into her bag. 20 minutes later, Jennifer had checked out and was aboard the shuttle back to the airport. This time, she knew where she would be flying. But what she would find there when she arrived, she couldn't begin to guess. It was hot in Las Vegas. She'd assumed it would be, but it was still only spring, and this was Africa hot. A searing, stifling heat, like standing beside a fire close enough to feel your skin cooking whenever you stopped moving. She rented a car from the Alamo stand in the airport, remembering, only a second before the board attendant asked for it, that she did not have a U.S. license. Fortunately, Her international driver's license, which she'd obtained before going to Swaziland, was still folded up with her passport. The attendant, barely college age, and ill at ease in a jacket and tie, peered at it dubiously, but didn't care enough to make trouble. He pushed the keys to a Chevy Impala across the counter to her, and sighed pointedly when, as an afterthought, she requested a GPS system. She had an address, but it wasn't like she knew where she was going, though she had studied a Google map on the plane and had a fair idea of where the government-protected wilderness land was supposed to be. Nate Hapsell's ranch bordered Nevada State Route 375 west of Crystal Springs. But it wasn't until she started driving, and the GPS calculated the route, that she got a sense of just how big America was. The flight from Washington made the point in one way, and she'd amused herself speculating where a flight of comparable length would have taken her from London. Russia? Turkey? Algeria? But it was only sitting in the driver's seat of the rented Impala, watching the miles go by, that the full scale of the place registered. The map she'd studied on her laptop had made it look like Las Vegas was right next to Crystal Springs. But even traveling nearly double the speed limit of all but the fastest UK roads, it took 2 hours to get there, crossing an unforgiving barren beige landscape of basin and range desert, as forbidding as anything she'd seen in Africa. She worried about being followed. It seemed unlikely. Frequent rear-view mirror checks showed nothing unusual, but if her intuition was correct, the people looking for her had access to serious resources. If some drone lazily circling a couple of thousand feet above her was tracking her cars every mile across the desert, she had no way of knowing. And if that drone is carrying a missile like the ones they used to take out terrorists in Iraq? Well, there was no point thinking about that. She thought of the words inscribed on the wall of the Jefferson Memorial. Those high ideals about freedom and equality, expanding as society evolved. Surely things couldn't have gone so far that a civilized and democratically elected government would target a visitor like her for elimination because she'd asked a few questions. It should have been a rhetorical question, but she thought of Senator Tom Powers, whose sudden suicide, according to the NPR report she had just heard, was being met with incredulity and suspicion from those who had worked with him. But then it didn't need to be a government pulling of strings of deceit, surveillance, and murder, did it? She had seen how much money the Maynard Consortium moved around. They could buy and sell most countries. However much people griped about governments and politicians, the power of corporate money had always scared her more. Nations turned on each other, fought bloody and devastating wars, but corporations somehow remained. Her father had taught her that. The Nazis had driven through the war in BMWs, Mercedes, and Daimlers. Porsche had designed their Tiger tanks. Fiat had done something similar for Mussolini's Italians. Mitsubishi, who built the pleasant, sporty-looking passenger sedan that just passed her, had spent the war years building the Japanese its most infamous fighter, the Zero. Corporations were society's cockroaches. They always survived. She would have forgotten these examples years ago if they had not become part of her anti-capitalist litany, rehearsed in many a university bar and charity work camp over the years. She suspected she was living that corporate reality now. And while she was used to the idea making her angry, its full terrifying potential was just beginning to register. It was like a breakaway civilization, she thought, a powerful, moneyed organization that owed no allegiance to geography or the other outmoded trappings of the nation-state. An entity that lived in the Internet, in anonymous boardrooms, in the interconnected invisible spaghetti of revenue streams and offshore accounts, unnoticed and impossibly powerful. A force moving beneath global affairs for its own ends. She knew the social media graphics about how the world's wealth was distributed. The less than 1%, who controlled over half the world's resources. And she knew how corporate interests had long shaped the most violent shifts in human history. We still think in terms of nations, ethnicities, and elected governments when we think of foreign policy and war, she mused. But what if that's all a blind? What if the driving interest is solely economic? That would be no great surprise. Middle Eastern oil, Russian gas pipelines. These things were clearly at the heart of recent conflicts. She thought of the Maynard Group's jolly chairman, and of Herman Salzberg, the cadaver who had haunted the dreams of her childhood, and the man who had called himself Latrange. All those men sitting around tables, amassing their fortunes, and changing the world to suit their whims with the stroke of a pen, the click of a mouse, the plummy eye of a vote, only the dozen people in that room even knew it was happening. She shifted in the seat. The hot plastic interior of the car was starting to smell. She turned the AC up higher and wondered how anyone would choose to live in the desert. But then, choice wasn't something most people had, was it? They chose which brand of sneakers to buy, or where to take their vacation. But other people controlled whether the places they worked stayed open, where they got their food from, or how much it would cost them to get on a plane. Real choice. Choice in the ways the Maynard Consortium understood the term. The power to control your own destiny. That was denied most people. She scowled. These were familiar ideas. There was something pompous about replaying them in her head, pompous and self-protective. She didn't want to think about what had happened to Tom Powers in D.C., or what had happened to her back in the shed, a stone's throw from Heathrow Airport, or what had happened to her own father. And she certainly didn't want to think about that particular phrase Powers had left dangling on the steps of the Jefferson Memorial. Unidentified aerial phenomena. What the hell was that supposed to mean? Money in politics, however appalling, she could understand. But if there was anything to that tantalizing, ridiculous three-word phrase, or if it had anything to do with what had happened to Powers, or her father, or her, it was beyond her ken. UFOs? The badge of crazy people. The insignia of the lunatic fringe. No. She would not go there. Choice, she thought bleakly. She'd chosen to be here, to chase down what she could find, like a mongoose going after a rat. Her money, her father's money, had allowed her to do that. She might be on the side of the ordinary people. She knew the term was condescending, but she wasn't one of them. She turned the radio on and found a country music station. The sounds were almost as alien to her as the landscape she was driving through. She left it on, figuring it was good to be reminded of just how far outside her comfort zone she was. The Hapsel place was set back from the main road, along a long, dusty track marked with a battered rural mailbox. She drove past twice before finding it, slowing the rental car to a rolling stop. This was no African Jeep, and she didn't want to fight with the Alamo people over the state of the chassis when she took it back. There was fencing on either side of the road, strands of barbed wire strung and rusting from wooden posts. It didn't look like it would keep anything in or out. But then there was no livestock she could see, just barren range. If anything grew here, this was clearly not its season. There were no signs designating that the land was in any way protected. Nothing saying it was home to any endangered species. 2 slow miles from the highway, she came to a metal gate, its white paint flaking and stained with pinkish clay. She got out, swung the gate open, drove through, and dutifully closed it beside her, as if she were out for a ramble across green English farms. The house, or rather homestead, a word which popped into her mind the moment she saw the place, was a two-story clapboard, painted white, but a very long time ago, no better maintained than the rest of the place, with a wooden porch where an elderly couple sat in matching rocking chairs, as if they had been waiting to have their picture taken for Life magazine 60 years ago. The man was grizzled, wearing sweat-stained overalls. The woman was grandmotherly, wearing a dress that would not have been considered attractive, even in the days when these territories were first settled by whites. There was a pitcher of lemonade, the glass sweating in the heat. For a moment, Jennifer wanted a drink from it more than anything else in the world.
"Afternoon," said the old man, not getting up, but smiling. "Help you with something?"
"Well," said Jennifer, who realized she should have spent less time in the car thinking about global inequality, and more about planning her rhetorical strategy.
"I was hoping to find Mr. Nate Hapsel."
"And you found him," said the old man, his smile widening. "Nate Hapsel, guilty as charged. What can I do you for?"
"Nate Hapsel," his wife scolded, "are you going to keep a young lady standing out there in the heat on a day like this?"
"Well, no," said the old man. "I was just getting through the pleasantries there. I think they'd be a good deal more pleasant sitting up here in the shade with a cold glass of lemonade, wouldn't you say, dear?"
said the old woman, turning to Jennifer.
"Well," said Jennifer, "it has been a long drive. Thank you. That would be lovely."
"You sound funny,"
Hapsel teased as Jennifer climbed onto the porch.
"Where you from? Australia?"
"England," said Jennifer.
"She's from England," Hapsel said to his wife. "I heard," the old woman replied. "Welcome to Nevada," she said to Jennifer, her smile touched with amazement. "I saw England once. Some of my people came from there. I'll get you a glass."
Jennifer settled into a rocker, a third, set out as if they had been expecting her, feeling a little dazed by her unexpected welcome.
"All the way from England to see me?" said Hapsel. "What's on your mind?"
He didn't add little lady, but it wouldn't have been unexpected. Jennifer looked at the sun-bleached porch, the hot, dusty land, and the massive expanse of blue sky overhead. It was like she'd wandered under the set of some old-time western.
"Well, I assume you know a Mr. Tom Powers, the senator," she said.
Hapsel frowned.
"Can't say that I do," he said. "Yes, you do," called his wife from inside. "The senator, the one who visited the high school 7 years ago, wanted to know if we would vote for him. You remember? Nate Hapsel, you don't have the memory of a housefly."
"She may be right," said Hapsel, still smiling genially. "So what about this senator?"
"Well, you heard he died?"
"Is that right? Ella," Hapsel called back, "the senator died." "You knew that," his wife returned. "It was on O'Reilly, Senator Tom Powers. He died in Washington, D.C.
Hapsel nodded thoughtfully.
"Yes, I did hear that," he said.
Jennifer blinked. This was not how she'd expected things to go. A long silence passed. She eyed the pitcher on the table and looked for Mrs. Hapsel, who was still in the back.
"Okay," she said at last. "Well, the senator was responsible, partly at least, for securing a preservation order for parts of your ranch, on the grounds of its ecological sensitivity, that it was the home to some endangered species. He told me you made a sizable contribution to his election campaign."
The old man's smile did not falter.
"I don't know how it is in England," he said, "but here, what a man does with his money is his own business."
"Absolutely," said Jennifer, backpedaling. "It just seems odd that you didn't remember who he was, after giving him $30,000.
"You heard the wife," said Hapsel, still grinning. "I don't remember nothing."
"And the protected environment?" Jennifer tried. "I didn't see any signs."
"Oh, that's up a ways," said Hapsel. 2 miles or more."
"Could I see it?"
"Not much to see. Bunch of fences and signs. It's not like you can go in. That's kind of the point. Protected, right?
Right, said Jennifer. The pitcher of lemonade was continuing to bead with condensation, and still she had no glass.
What sort of ranch is this, Mr. Hafsel?
Why?
I just didn't see any livestock.
Nope.
I saw tracks in the dust on the side of the road, she said. It looked like heavy vehicles had come along the path. Lots of them recently. But if you don't have livestock, then I guess they weren't cattle trucks.
Hafsel's smile, if anything, got wider.
Randy nodded as if reflecting on something fascinating she had said.
What might cause those tracks, Mr. Hafsel? Jennifer pressed.
The old man gazed out over the dry fields and sipped his lemonade. At last, he turned back toward the house and called,
"You got that glass yet, Ella? The lady will be parched."
His wife emerged almost at once with a tall glass that, after setting down the phone in her other hand, she filled from the pitcher and then handed the glass to Jennifer.
"You just have time to drink it before they get here," said the old woman pleasantly.
"What?" asked Jennifer, the glass halfway to her lips, her eyes flashing from Mrs. Hafsel to the phone and back.
"Who?"
The old woman turned and gazed back along the dirt road, shading her eyes with one hand.
"See?" she hid. "Here they come now."
Jennifer got awkwardly to her feet and followed Mrs. Hafsel's gaze to where a black SUV was barreling along the road towards them, churning up orange dust in a long billowing cloud behind it. She turned an anxious look on the old man and his rocker.
"Drink up," he said. "They're generally not as hospitable as we are."
41. Tamika. Location unknown. Tamika Mars awoke slowly, her senses returning bit by bit. Hearing first, then smell, then touch, and finally, sight. The process took several unnatural minutes. It took all that and more for her mind to guess that she had been drugged and restrained. Just before her eyes opened, she tried rolling onto her side, aware that she was lying on her back on a cool, hard surface, her upper body slightly elevated. She could not move. It was another few minutes before she realized that this was a result of something other than her body's strange lethargy. Her wrists were anchored at her sides to whatever she was lying on, and when she tried to flex them, she felt a flash of muted pain, as if some of her skin had been rubbed raw. Her memory returned, but only in bits and pieces. She'd been driving along a deserted Pennsylvania road in the dark. There were trees and road markings. She recalled a nagging anxiety about what would come out of the woods. No, she amended, that wasn't it. She'd been worried about being followed. That was it. She had been somewhere. There was something just out of reach of her mind, something as dark as the forest she'd been driving through. But when she reached for it, it slipped away. And now she was here. Her eyes were open, but her vision remained blurry, unfocused. There were monitors with lights that strobed or blinked periodically on either side of her. She had a sudden recollection of being 14, when she had been playing outside for 8 hours in a hot New York summer and had collapsed from dehydration, hitting her head on the curb. It was the only time she'd ever been hospitalized, and the first time a doctor had hinted that she could stand to lose a few pounds. She hadn't thought of it for years. The vividness of the memory distressed her, like she'd somehow gone back to that day, waking groggily to find herself an inconvenience who had brought this on herself. She squeezed her eyes shut, then opened them again. And this time, the room came into sharper focus.
It was not the room in the hospital where she had woken up. The machines were similar, but the room itself was blank and white, more like an emergency surgical operating room or a lab. Something in her stirred with unease. You were driving through trees. The car. Something about the car. Some kind of accident? No. The car had stopped. Then there'd been a light all around her, from above. God. She tried moving again, testing to see what she could feel, whether there was numbness or an absence where a limb should be, but felt only the tension in her wrist again, the discomfort edging into pain. She looked down at it, her head swimming. A thin nylon strap, like a zip tie, was looped around her hand on the proximal side of her thumb, and then through the metal slats of the gurney, or whatever it was she was lying on. The skin looked pink and swollen as she twisted it. The act focused her mind. She was still wearing the same clothes, though her jacket was missing. Tubes and wires snaked around her. Some were clustered between the cups of her bra, stuck in place with sticky pads that rose and fell as she breathed. One seemed to actually go into her left arm. An IV, she thought, dimly, trailing from a bag of colorless fluid on a stand. The room itself was hexagonal, like the cell of a beehive. The floor matted with some dark rubbery substance. The walls white to waist height, then a broad stripe of dark, smoky glass she couldn't see through. What looked like a door, without a handle or knob, was set in the wall to her right. Her head was filled with a strange white noise, part static, part layered harmonics, almost music, that did not seem to change, no matter how she moved her head. As she looked around, still too sleepy and confused to be truly scared, two monitors set into the wall, above the band of dark glass, began to flash with a bright, unsettling light, an uncanny, poisonous green. Gradually, she registered that this was somehow connected to her waking. And now the smoky glass was not quite as opaque as it had been. There were shapes on the other side of the glass, two, possibly three, barely visible, except when they moved. She wanted to think they were people, but something in the shape of their heads. The fear that simmered unrecognized within her grew hotter, more urgent. She uttered a low moan, but she heard nothing but the strange ambient sound that coursed through her skull. "Who are you?" she tried to say. "What do you want?" Her lips felt rubbery, her mouth dry. But that didn't account for how distant and muted her own voice sounded. Something had happened to her. It was still happening. She clamped her teeth together, then tried again, this time working her jaw until she caught a little fold of her cheek between her teeth. She pressed down hard, and the pain worked on her mind like the ache in her wrist had. She tasted blood, but she could feel her body coming back to life, brightening, fading, then brightening again. She bit down, and a slow pulse of energy rippled from her toes to her knees, pelvis, torso, shoulders. She felt it in her arms where, apart from the restrained wrists, she had the most freedom of motion. She stirred, and it was like rousing a sleeping animal. Fear and anxiety were momentarily replaced by something else. Anger, hostility, rage. These were good things, she thought, as her brain fought to control what it had awoken. They might keep her alive. "What is your name?" The sound was suddenly all around her, arcing out of the static, as if the voice were coming from the machines to which she was connected. It was terrifying. A strange, slow hiss that blurred the oddly accented words together, distorting the sound, rolling it like waves, so that each sound faded in and out, without ever truly beginning or ending. She gasped, but said nothing coherent. And a moment later, the strange, unearthly voice came back.
"What is your name?"
"My name is Tamika Mars," she answered, though she could barely hear herself.
"Where am I?"
There was no reply, only the strange oscillation of sound that was almost music in her head.
"Where were you going?"
It was clearer this time, though the distortion was as before, with the same curious foreign lilt, as if the speaker were not using his mouth. "His," she thought, struck by the pronoun her mind had offered. Yes, the voice, for all its strangeness, sounded male. The light behind the smoked glass seemed to brighten, and the figures beyond moved, shadowy and unreal. Their heads were too large, elongated. Thoughtless with dread, Tamika fought with her bonds, pulling back and forth where she felt the zip tie snag against the underside of the table.
"Where were you going?"
the voice demanded again. The same flat tone, the inflection all wrong. It didn't feel like she was hearing it. It was just there, in her head, like it came from deep inside her own mind.
"I don't remember," she said, fear making her honest. "I was driving through a forest. I had been to see someone, an old lady, but I don't know."
She stopped as more pieces of memory slotted into place. The hollows, and a dead man called Jersey, who had once been a prisoner. Like her. She fought the zip ties once more.
"Do not struggle," said the voice. "You will become injured."
The last word had three syllables. Someone who did not speak English fluently. Someone. Yes. Because the alternative was too terrible to acknowledge. She continued to pull at her wrist ties, raising her whole body from the reclined table, shaking it, thrashing her head and shoulders as much as her restraints would let her. She felt the blood run from her right wrist and, glorying in her rage, because it felt so much better than the skulking terror which would otherwise overwhelm her, roared her defiance. Still, her voice sounded muted and far away. But as she twisted her head violently, one way, then the other, something popped out of her right ear and landed on her chest. An earbud with a thin yellow wire. She stopped thrashing and stared at it, anger lessening as logic took over. The voice was not in her head. It was being piped through to her from outside. With that, some of her fear abated. This was not metaphysics. It was communication. She forced herself to think, to analyze. That was what she was known for, right? The thought came to her, a piece of her past that she'd forgotten, and with it came a word she knew, debunction.
Yes, that was who she was. That was what she did.
She dismantled fictions and fairy tales, cheats, ruses, hoaxes. But then the lights in the strange hexagonal cell dimmed, and silently, awfully, the door panel she'd almost forgotten slid aside. The three strange figures were watching her, and now one of them was coming in. She saw the gangly gray frame, the long, impossible fingers, the bulbous head with the vast insect eyes. And all her former terror returned, blotting out any sense of who she was, leaving only a mad dread of what would happen next. It moved gracelessly, a shuffling, shambling step, and though it angled its head to one side, then the other as it considered her, it moved awkwardly, turning its whole body in the direction it was, as if it couldn't see well. Tamika's eyes flashed around the room in search of salvation. As she did so, she wrestled with her restraints, tugging, stretching, making the underside of the tabletop into a saw. Now that one ear was free of the headset through which they had been speaking to her, she could hear her own panic, the wordless grunting exertion, the labored breathing, the cringing, whimpering dread as the creature came near her. Creature was wrong. She knew what she was looking at, even if she couldn't bring herself to say the word. Anybody would. Certainly anybody who had spent years mocking every account of these X-Files extras. It came closer, its cautious, shuffling steps, suddenly the only sound in the room, reaching towards her, its long fingers so terrible, so alien. And there it was. Her brain